But rationality demands that physicians be sensitive to the totality of evidence. It may be time to ask whether ours are. Finally, remember some of the tips toward rational discussion taken from the negotiation literature. There's no guarantee, but if we can go to the balcony, if we can pull the plug on ego, if we can change the game from confrontational debate to joint investigation, we at least stand a chance. Is rhetoric at issue here? Absolutely. We'll talk more about that next time. In the last lecture, I tried to offer some ideas on working toward rationality in polarized contexts. This lecture focuses on something characteristic of polarized contexts, rhetoric. In this lecture, I want to talk about rhetoric versus rationality. Rhetoric has acquired a bad name. It's hard to say rhetoric without empty or mere in front of it, mere rhetoric. But that wasn't always the case. Let me start with a little history. At one time, rhetoric was highly respected as a required skill for effective speaking and presentation of ideas. Plato has a dialogue on the theme, the Gorgias, named after a prominent teacher of rhetoric. Aristotle has a major work on the topic, Aristotle's Rhetoric. The Roman orator Cicero was famous as a teacher of rhetoric. In her biography of Cleopatra, Stacy Schiff argues that Cleopatra's success was due far more to her skill in rhetoric than her supposed beauty. Classical education throughout the Middle Ages was based on the trivium, consisting of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Those were the foundations of a liberal education, the areas everyone was expected to master. But the dark side of rhetoric also became clear early on. It's a theme in Plato's Gorgias. There, Plato has Socrates argue that rhetoric involves no real knowledge or sense of justice, that rhetoric alone, unalloyed with philosophy, is merely a form of deceptive advertising or flattery. One has to remember that at that time, the rhetoricians were, in a sense, philosophy's competitors. Plato's anti-rhetoric dialogue is also remarkable for its effectiveness, that is, for the effectiveness of its rhetoric. In his work on the topic, Aristotle admits that rhetorical skills can be used for either good or bad. His task is to analyze persuasion. What is it that makes a presentation effective? That's still a good question. Even contemporary attempts to answer it would do well to start with Aristotle, and often do. What makes a presentation effective? Three things. The persuasiveness of a presentation depends, first of all, on the character of the speaker. We are convinced by people we see as knowledgeable and wise, as effective leaders who are in the right. Aristotle calls that ethos. Second, the persuasiveness of a presentation depends on the emotions of the hearer. A message that resonates emotionally is one that's going to be more effective. Aristotle calls that pathos. Third, persuasiveness depends on the logic of the argument. Do you want to persuade? Lay out the argument clearly and rationally, step by step. That's logos. When I think of rhetoric, I think of Mark Antony's, "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears." But of course, that's not a quote from Mark Antony himself. It comes from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Education in Elizabethan England was saturated with the classics, even elementary education. Shakespeare is reputed to have studied at the King's Free Grammar School in Stratford. No records remain, so we don't know for sure. Might Shakespeare have read Aristotle's rhetoric? All we have is speculation. In support of that speculation, however, are the two prominent speeches at Caesar's funeral in Shakespeare's play. The first speech is by Brutus, one of the assassins. "Hear me for my cause and be silent, that you may hear. Believe me for mine honor and have respect to mine honor." That looks like an attempt to establish character, Aristotle's ethos. The Shakespearean scholars Charles and Michelle Martindale further characterized Brutus's speech in terms of logos, as a style for the intellect. If someone asks why Brutus rose against Caesar, this is my answer, not that I loved Caesar less, but that I loved Rome more. Mark Antony gives a speech in response to Brutus's, and it's very different. Ironic and indirect, where Brutus's is explicit and direct, Mark Antony undercuts Brutus's built-up ethos with a mockingly repeated phrase. Brutus says that Caesar was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. When that the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. I thrice presented him a kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. As the Martindales note, the currency of Antony's speech is not logic, but emotion, pathos. Quote, if you have tears, prepare to shed them now. Look, in this place ran Cassius's dagger through. See what a rent the envious Casca made. Through this, the well-beloved Brutus stabbed, the most unkindest cut of all. So what do you think? Is that evidence that Shakespeare knew Aristotle's rhetoric? What of Abraham Lincoln? My colleague at Stony Brook, the political scientist Frank Myers, points out that all three elements of Aristotle's rhetoric are artfully managed in Lincoln's famous Cooper Union speech. Lincoln and Stephen Douglas were rival candidates for the Senate from Illinois and held debates across the state. Parts of those debates gained national attention in the newspapers. Lincoln lost the election for senator, but shortly afterward was invited to speak at the Cooper Union in New York. Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, said that no former speech writing had cost Lincoln so much time and thought. Here's what an eyewitness said. When Lincoln rose to speak, I was greatly disappointed. He was tall, oh, how tall, and so angular and awkward that I had for an instant a feeling of pity for so ungainly a man. Add to that the fact that Lincoln spoke not in the deep, resonant voice we remember from so many portrayals, but in a high-pitched accent blending frontier Indiana and Kentucky. The question of the day was whether the federal government had the right to control the expansion of slavery into the Western territories. With no flowery introduction, Lincoln takes on the question in terms of the Constitution. He gives a detailed and scholarly examination of the relevant views and related actions of each of the 39 delegates who signed it. Despite his appearance, despite his frontier accent, Lincoln uses that first part of the speech to establish himself as knowledgeable and indeed scholarly with regard to the questions at issue. That same eyewitness who was disappointed on first impression says that once Lincoln started speaking, his face lighted up as with an inward fire. The whole man was transfigured. I forgot his clothes, his personal appearance, and his individual peculiarities. Presently, forgetting myself, I was cheering this wonderful man. Lincoln has established that first element of Aristotle's rhetoric, the impression of character. The third element of Aristotle's rhetoric is the logic of the argument. That, too, Lincoln worked on long and hard. His law partner Herndon says rightly that the speech was constructed with a view to accuracy of statement, simplicity of language, and unity of thought. In some respects, like a lawyer's brief, it was logical and temperate in tone. Aristotle's three modes of persuasion are character, logic, and emotion. But emotion only appears in the very last part of Lincoln's speech. Had he started with an emotional appeal, it's likely people would have seen only a ranter from the wilderness. What he needed first were character and logic. He saves emotion for the conclusion. Neither let us be slandered from our duty by false accusations against us, nor frightened from it by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves. Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. There are similar analyses of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in terms of Aristotle's rhetoric. So why did rhetoric get a bad name? Perhaps because one element of Aristotle's three can be faked. Ethos, the aspect of character. You'll be just as persuasive if you can make yourself appear knowledgeable as you will if you really are. No need to really know what you're talking about, just look the part. Another element of Aristotle's three is prime territory for manipulation, pathos. Appeal to emotion is so clearly an element beyond the rational that it appears on the list of standard fallacies. Is emotion itself wrong? No. Indeed, we've seen how important it is. But when an appeal to reason is replaced by something intended merely to push our emotional buttons, it's not rational persuasion, but emotional manipulation at work. Our contemporary and negative sense of rhetoric is firmly in place in the work of the 19th century philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer's major work was The World as Will and Representation. Cited as a major influence on Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, Freud, Einstein, and, unfortunately, on Adolf Hitler. Schopenhauer was also the author of The Art of Controversy, a user's guide to rhetoric in the contemporary negative sense. He characterizes the topic as intellectual fencing, used for the purpose of getting the best of a dispute, period. He admits it has nothing to do with truth. Thrust and parry is the whole business. Chapter 3 of Schopenhauer's book is titled Stratagems. It's a list of 38 rhetorical tricks. It might as well be called How to Win an Argument by Any Means Possible. Schopenhauer's irony is evident. Some of the tricks explicitly manipulate emotion. Make your opponent angry, Schopenhauer says. He won't think straight. How should you do that? By doing him repeated injustice or practicing some kind of chicanery and being generally insolent. If he does become angry, Schopenhauer says, you should press your case with even more zeal. Irritate him by contradiction and contention until he exaggerates his original statement. Even though what your opponent originally said was right, hone in on the exaggeration. But when you refute this exaggerated form, you look as though you had also refuted his original statement, says Schopenhauer. If it looks like your opponent is getting the upper hand, become personal, insulting, and rude. That's the rhetoric we're more familiar with, the kind of rhetoric we're all too familiar with. In the last lecture, we talked about how to strive for rationality in a polarized context. There, a major strategy was to try to lift the dispute out of rhetoric, to remove it from Schopenhauer's intellectual fencing debate context, to go to the balcony, looking at the issue at a distance removed from ego involvement and emotion. But what is one to do when that's not possible? The best defense is to know the enemy and see it coming. But by enemy, I don't mean the other side. The enemy is rhetoric. One can guard against rhetoric by getting to know it, even by getting good at it. The best defense against mere rhetoric is to know its tactics well enough to call them by name and parry them when they come. Appeal to emotion is one of those tactics. Emotion itself isn't bad. Life and even rationality would be impossible without it. But there are points at which something more is required. Careful weighing of alternatives, consideration of evidence, tracking potential consequences, and after due consideration, making a decision. Appeal to emotion is intended to cross-circuit all that, pushing your buttons instead of appealing to your reason. Watch out for it. Appeal to emotion is often by means of emotionally loaded words. There are lots of ways to say something. Consider, Bill came home late, as opposed to Bill snuck into the house long after he was due. The basic facts may be the same. The portrayal is not, precisely because of the emotional language in that second case. Consider Jones won the election, as opposed to, against all odds, Jones finally triumphed over the status quo. The difference is all those emotionally loaded words. So when you hear something like this, Fanatics on the religious right have wormed their way into the most powerful and privileged positions of the Republican Party. Now they're really going to start shoving things down our throats. Figure out what it really says when it's drained of the rhetorical phrases that are a mere appeal to emotion. There are other classic fallacies that appear on Schopenhauer's list of rhetorical tricks. The stratagem known as straw man fallacy appears in a number of forms. Schopenhauer recommends exaggerating the claims made on the other side. That will, of course, make them easier to refute. He recommends twisting the words used on the other side so that they mean something different than intended. Ignore your opponent's real position. Confuse the issue by imputing something different. The fallacy is called straw man because you're no longer arguing against the opponent's real position. It's as if you can't beat Billy in a fair fight, so you go home and take it out on a dummy made of straw. Take that, Billy, you say, effectively demolishing not the real Billy, just the straw man. We'll cover other fallacies in later lectures. Ad hominem, appeal to authority, and diversion. Those appear on Schopenhauer's list as well. Among Schopenhauer's recommendations is a standard debating trick. Shift the burden of proof to the opponent. One way is simply to say, "This is my position. Go ahead. Prove me wrong." That, of course, relieves you of the burden of proving yourself right. It's your opponent who's on the spot. But, of course, the fact that he may not be able to prove you wrong doesn't really prove that you're right. Schopenhauer also recommends that you lump the opponent's position into some odious category. That's fascism, you can say. Or, that's socialism. Don't bother to explain why the view is fascism or even what fascism is. The emotionally loaded category is meant to do all the work by itself, and it often does. If all else fails, Schopenhauer says, bluff, or throw so many unrelated charges that your opponent doesn't have a chance to respond to them all, or bewilder him with mere bombast, or become personal, insulting, and rude. Schopenhauer's rhetorical recommendations are ironic, of course. He didn't want to be a victim of bombast any more than we do. But look at how far rhetoric in that sense is from what Aristotle meant. Look at how far rhetoric in that sense is from the presentational dynamics of Lincoln's Cooper Union address. Unfortunately, it's not so far from what we've become accustomed to in political argument. Rhetorical tricks may be particularly characteristic of political argument in contemporary media. What would the Cooper Union address look like today, as reported by any of the major broadcast media? There are cases in which a full speech by a candidate becomes part of the media stream. Barack Obama's speech on race in the midst of the 2008 campaign is an example. But most contemporary political media consists of sound clips extracted from some larger speech or 30-second political commercials. Those are contexts made for rhetoric. Logos and ethos don't have time to do their work in a soundbite, but pathos does. It only takes a split second for an appeal to emotion to do its dirty work. Rhetoric, in the sense of Schopenhauer's tricks, was made for the intellectual fencing characteristic of debate in sound bites. I've said that it's important to develop an appreciation for rhetorical tricks. I'm not advocating that you employ them to win your next argument. I urge you to learn them as a means of intellectual self-defense. Knowing the tricks will help you guard against being on the receiving end of those tricks. There's another lesson here regarding the ethics of argument. If you're like me, you find rhetorical tricks intellectually repulsive. Schopenhauer's list has all the charm of a wax museum arcade of famous murderers. These are tips on how to win arguments, or at least on how to appear to win. These are tips for one-upmanship in the fencing matches of debates. But the serious question isn't how to win arguments. The real question is when to win arguments, or even whether to win arguments. The real question is whether winning is what we're after all. Schopenhauer says that the intellectual fencing he's talking about has nothing to do with truth, and that's precisely the problem. By my lights, rational discussion, like rational argument, should be about the truth. A truth that may include the truth about people's rights, about best available policy, or about reasonable accommodation between different interests. We want to work toward the truth by means of rational argument. Reasoning with others, like reasoning with ourselves, comes with a built-in goal to work toward the truth. Persuasion alone isn't a worthy goal. That's mere rhetoric. Let's return to rhetoric on the positive side. What study of rhetoric emphasizes is that rationality isn't an exclusively individual undertaking. Rationality is something that we can and should practice together. Rational discussion is just that, discussion. Discussion is a social endeavor, and rationality may actually demand a social dynamics. What rhetoric emphasizes, at its best, not its worst, is the social dynamics of intellectual exchange. Often it's only when we see ideas in a context of discussion, or even civil debate, that we can see them most clearly. That's certainly the theory in criminal law and in high-cost civil suits. The adversarial system is based on the conviction that it's from the clash of arguments in which each side presents its best case, subject to cross-examination, that the truth will out. Does the truth always out in adversarial proceedings? I don't know anyone who thinks so. We all know that a case may be carried by lawyers' rhetorical tricks, appeal to emotion on the part of the jury, for example, rather than by the force of evidence and argument. But I don't know anyone who thinks we should replace that system with a single inquisitor, doing all the investigating by himself, asking all the questions, and then serving as both judge and jury. The consensus seems to be that there is at least a better chance that the truth will out when we have arguments and evidence laid out on opposing sides, with a final verdict left to the collective deliberations of the jury. In Lecture 9, we used flow diagrams to graph the logical flow of an argument. In that context, we were talking about an argument as a one-sided affair. We were trying to graph the logical flow from a set of propositions offered as reasons to the conclusion they were meant to support. Are they working independently, or as a set of dependent reasons that have to work together? In the last part of that lecture, we expanded the technique to two types of reasons, data and warrant, based on the work of the 20th century philosopher Stephen Tolman. The idea is that a premise may be giving you an evidential base, a piece of information or data, or it may be giving you the warrant that allows you to draw a particular conclusion from that data. Tolman's larger project was to reintroduce, rehabilitate, and modernize the study of rhetoric as a study of argument in the sense of discourse, the exchange of ideas between two or more interlocutors. He was out to reintroduce, rehabilitate, and modernize the study of rhetoric. Let's expand our earlier visualization, then, in order to see how one can graph an argument on both sides of an issue. We'll use a simple exchange between two people.
So I figured out what's wrong with the washing machine. The belt is broken.
What makes you think that?
You can hear the motor running, but nothing else turns.
And that makes you think it's the belt?
Well, that would explain it. If the belt was broken, the motor can turn all at once, but nothing else will.
But maybe it's something jammed in the main drum. The motor would work then, but the drum wouldn't turn even if there wasn't any problem with the belt.
I guess so, but that's pretty unlikely. Let's just say it's probably the belt.
Well, let's take a look.
You couldn't find a more normal exchange. Broken appliances. A delightful break from broken politics, anyway. Here's how we might construct a flow diagram of that little exchange. Mark makes the first claim we're interested in. The belt is broken. That's really his conclusion. We don't have his reasoning yet. Tessa draws that out. What makes you think that? He gives the data on which his conclusion is based. You can hear the motor running, but nothing turns. So at this point, we can do a diagram that goes from Mark's data to his conclusion. Look at the two pieces of his data, by the way. You can hear the motor running, nothing turns. Remember the distinction we made before. Are those working independently or dependently? They're working dependently. Mark is presenting them as two pieces of the puzzle which together lead him to believe that the belt's broken. Just hearing the motor running wouldn't tell him that. Nothing turns wouldn't be specific enough. Those are offered as pieces of evidence which together suggest a conclusion. But now Tessa asks, and what makes you think it's the belt? Note that she isn't asking a question about the data. She's asking a question about, maybe even challenging, the inference from the data to the conclusion. She's really asking, do you think that data warrants the conclusion that the belt's broken? The warrant is what's supposed to carry us from the data to the conclusion. I'll write in Tessa's question as a challenge at that point. We'll use blue for Mark's contributions, yellow indicate Tessa's. Mark answers the challenge by providing a warrant. Well, that would explain it. He offers further backing by spelling out the explanation. If the belt's broken, the motor can turn all it wants, but nothing else will. At this point, Tessa offers a counter-hypothesis. Maybe it's something jammed in the main drum. Note that she doesn't deny the data Mark offered. In fact, she's going to use that data with a different warrant for the opposing conclusion. I'll change Mark's original data to a different color to indicate that both people are now using it. Tessa uses the same data toward an alternative conclusion, though a qualified conclusion. Maybe it's something jammed in the main drum. Her warrant is an alternative explanation, spelled out with further backing. If something is jammed, the motor would work, but the drum wouldn't turn, even if there is no problem with the belt. Note that Tessa's is now a structure parallel to Mark's. She too uses the data as dependent premises, but her warrant is an alternative that would explain it, with a different backing. Note that I've also marked her maybe as a qualification on her conclusion. Maybe something is jammed in the main drum. Mark ends by conceding that Tessa has an alternative explanation backing an alternative hypothesis. I guess so. He introduces a challenge to Tessa's explanation. It's pretty unlikely. But at the same time, he adds a qualification to his own claim. Let's just say it's probably the belt. What we've graphed is not just an argument on one side, but the exchange of arguments on both sides. Luckily, Mark and Tessa have listened to the previous lecture on how to work rationally within a polarized context. Tessa suggests that they put the matter to an objective test. Let's take a look. There's nothing magic about the way I've sketched the logic of the discussion. Where the pattern of an argument is really important, I urge you to try sketching it out as a graph, with whatever conventions seem most useful to you. When I expect a philosophical discussion to become complex, I sometimes sketch it out in advance. I include not only exchanges I've heard, but possible exchanges to come. Graphs with branches for different possibilities. Perhaps he'll use this argument. Perhaps she'll make this reply. In that case, my best response is probably this one. In that kind of case, I'll be trying to muster the best argument that can be made on one side. But it's still Aristotle's logos that I'll be trying to use. I'm not plotting rhetorical tricks. I'm trying to map out the alleys we can expect to explore in search of the truth. The analysis of a rational discussion differs from that of a single argument in that there will be more than just premises and conclusions, more than even data warrant and conclusions. There will be challenges raised on one side, which will force qualifications on the other, and which may well evoke refinement of the argument and further backup in response. Complicated? Yes. And yet in normal discourse, we manage to follow the train of thought, the logical flow of argument, all the time. What graphic visualization allows is the possibility of seeing that logical flow. What we've done here is to expand our graphing tools into the social context of discourse. There are a number of points regarding rationality and rhetoric that I hope you'll take home from this lecture. What makes a presentation persuasive? Remember the three themes in Aristotle's rhetoric: character, emotion, and reasoning; ethos, pathos, and logos. Remember some of the dirty tricks on Schopenhauer's list. not in order to slaughter the opposition, but so that you can defend yourself against rhetoric's dark side. Try sketching out the flow of a discussion. Develop the ability to visualize the pattern of an exchange by starting with short and simple examples. I also hope you remember that argument comes with an ethics. The best that mere rhetoric could offer is mere winning. Truth and genuine rationality demand a far higher standard than that. Let me remind you of the requirements for a good argument. The first requirement is validity, a tight logical connection between premises and conclusion. In order to be valid, the reasons given for the conclusion must really support that conclusion. The conclusion must really follow from the premises. At its strongest, validity is deductive validity, Aristotle style. There, the connection is airtight. Given the truth of the premises, the truth of the conclusion is absolutely guaranteed. More broadly, validity demands a strong logical connection between premises and conclusion, even if not absolutely guaranteed. Do the reasons give us convincing evidence for the conclusion? Do they give solid reason to believe it? The first requirement is validity, that the premises, if true, will lead us by strong logic to the conclusion. The second requirement for a good argument is that the premises actually be true. A sound argument is one that's both valid and has premises which are indeed true. That's the kind of argument that will give us a conclusion we can rely on. That's a good argument. In this lecture, I want to go over to the dark side. In this lecture, I want to give you some really bad arguments. That sounds terrible, doesn't it? Of course, I'm not going to try to persuade you with bad arguments. I'm going to try to vaccinate you against them. Bad arguments, like flu germs, are all around us. But we can prepare ourselves with a flu shot that strengthens the immune system against expected types. With bad arguments, we can prepare ourselves by learning to recognize the most common forms, the usual suspects. If you can see them coming, you can more easily detect and diffuse them. There are bad argument types that reappear over and over again. Those standard forms of bad arguments are called fallacies. What I want to give you is a tour of some standard fallacies. The idea is, once again, to rely on your pattern recognition abilities. I want you to be able to say, "Ah, I recognize that pattern of argument. One of the usual suspects. It even has a name. That's an ad hominem argument." We've already talked about some standard forms of bad argument. Appeal to emotion and the straw man fallacy appeared in Schopenhauer's list of rhetorical tricks. Here we'll cover some more. In each case, I'll start out with simple examples. As I go along, I'll occasionally stop to review by asking you to name that fallacy. How many kinds of bogus arguments are there? All too many. I'm not even sure there's a limit. Were I to try to give you a complete list of all the ways an argument can go bad, I'll bet some clever advertising executive could come up with a new one. A first warning, then, is that I can't give you an exhaustive list. We'll just hit some of the most common offenders. A second warning is this. When people start to recognize bogus arguments, they often want a single answer to the question, "What's wrong with this argument?" But an argument can go wrong lots of different ways at once. There's no guarantee that only one fallacy will be committed. I'm going to be using lots of examples. Fallacies appear in social and political argument all the time, and I'll be using a number of social and political examples. Let me make it clear that those are only examples. I'm not pushing any particular agenda on any of those issues. Bad arguments appear on just about every side of every issue. And of course, the fact that someone supports a conclusion with a bad argument doesn't mean that there might not be a better argument that supports the same conclusion. First stop on the tour of bad arguments. Every parent is familiar with the refrain, but everybody else is doing it. Every parent is also familiar with the appropriate reply, "That's no reason why you should." The fact that everybody else is doing it is no reason why you should. And the fact that everybody else believes something is no reason why you should. Arguments which treat majority opinion as if that alone constituted a reason for belief commit the fallacy of appeal to the majority. Here's a simple example.
The majority of the population thinks we coddle criminals. It's time we got tough on crime.
The premise? A majority of the population thinks we coddle criminals. The conclusion? It's time we got tough on crime. Just how much support does that premise give for that conclusion? Not much. That's the fallacy of appeal to the majority. Sometimes the appeal isn't even to a majority.
A significant portion of the population takes UFO sightings seriously. UFOs are real.
Fallacious for the same reason, right? There's a simple fact that diffuses a number of common fallacies, including appeal to the majority. It's this. The fact that someone believes something doesn't make it so. We're all fallible. Anybody could be wrong. I don't care who you are, the President of the United States, or the head of NASA, or the chair of the physics department. Nobody is exempt from the possibility of error. It's never the case that something is true just because you believe it's true. You aren't that important to the universe. It's not all about you. You hope that what you believe is true, but the truth doesn't depend on what you happen to believe. The fact that someone believes something doesn't make it so. The fact that a whole bunch of people believe something doesn't make it so. The fact that a majority of people believe something doesn't make it so. So maybe it's true that we coddle criminals. Maybe it's true that there are UFOs. But in order for an argument to give us a solid reason to believe those things, it had better offer something stronger than the fact that some people, lots of people, maybe even a majority of people, believe those things. You may not be tempted by appeal to the majority. It's too obviously fallacious. Here's a fallacy that just about everyone has committed, and has committed on themselves. Two things happen in sequence, and we conclude they must be causally connected. The name of the fallacy is a bit of Latin, post hoc ergo propter hoc. What it means is, this came after this, so it must have been because of this. Post hoc ergo propter hoc, or post hoc for short. Here's how we fall victim. I'm waiting for my friends to arrive. They said they were coming over this afternoon, but I've been waiting and waiting. Finally, I decide to call them. I pick up the phone, and they drive in the driveway. Good thing I picked up that phone. Brains seem to be wired to make connections, even connections that aren't really there. Much of what is termed superstitious behavior is grounded in post hoc ergo propter hoc. Professional baseball is a prime example. Outfielder John White gave the typical story. I was jogging out to center field when I picked up a scrap of paper. I got some good hits that night, and I guess I decided that the paper had something to do with it. The next night I picked up a gum wrapper and had another good night. I've been picking up paper every night since. Wade Boggs eats chicken before every game because he thought he did well as a rookie after eating chicken. Clint Barm's ankle was taped after he sprained it. Because he started hitting well, he insisted it be taped up long after the sprain had healed. Elements of ritual build up. As Dennis Grossini, a pitcher on the Detroit farm team, said, "You can't really tell what's most important, so it all becomes important. I'd be afraid to change anything. As long as I'm winning, I do everything the same." So Turk Wendell chews four pieces of black licorice while pitching, insists on throwing the rosin bag down hard, draws three crosses in the dirt. Mike Hargrove was a first baseman for the Cleveland Indians. He built up such an elaborate routine he was known as the human rain delay, all because of post hoc ergo propter hoc. Sometimes things are just coincidences. The fact that A happened and then B happened doesn't show that A caused B. Let me give you a third bad argument type with another Latin name, ad hominem. An ad hominem argument is one that attacks the opponent himself as a person rather than his position. Ad hominem means against the person. Here it is in a simple form. You're in a debate. Your opponent has argued brilliantly that racial profiling is both unconstitutional and morally wrong, that it violates inherent human rights. It's your turn, and you say, "Where'd you get that shirt, Nutmeg? If you notice your socks don't match, where'd you get that argument off the back of a candy wrapper? Your mother wears army boots." Of course, ad hominem is often a bit more subtle. Here's another example.
The Republicans say we should shrink the deficit and cut down on government spending. But these are the same people who cranked up the deficit by getting us into two wars simultaneously. And these are the same people who cranked up the deficit by giving tax breaks to the rich. Yeah, and these are the same people who gave us the Bush years of massive spending, which was more than any other administration from either party.
What's really at issue here is the claim that we should shrink the deficit and cut down on government spending. But in fact, that claim is never addressed at all. What we get instead is an attack on the people who put it forward. That's ad hominem, an attack on the person rather than the claim. With truth and rationality on the line, what's important is the quality of the argument itself. If the argument is solid, it doesn't matter where it came from. Put it this way. Good arguments are good arguments in the dark. They are good arguments even if you can't see who's giving them. That's the principle violated by the fallacy of ad hominem. Ad hominem applies to any case in which the attack is on the person rather than the argument. There are two specific forms of ad hominem that reappear again and again, particularly in election years. The first is tu quoque, Latin for you also, or more colloquially, you did it too. The last example I gave you was a tu quoque form of ad hominem.
The Republicans say we should shrink the deficit and cut down on government spending. But these are the same people who cranked up the deficit by getting us into two wars simultaneously.
That's tu quoque. Does it show that they're wrong about the deficit and government spending? No. The most it shows is that Republicans have also been part of the problem. Here's another tu quoque.
Well, the U.S. says that North Korea is stockpiling nuclear weapons and is therefore a threat to world peace. But surely both Israel and the U.S. have their own stockpiles of nuclear weapons.
Does this show that North Korea is not stockpiling nuclear weapons? Or that it's not a danger to world peace? No. It's just a you did it too. A second form of ad hominem is poisoning the well. Like all ad hominems, it involves an attack on the person rather than the argument, but specifically an attack on someone's motives for saying what they do. They're just saying that because you can't trust water from that well. That's poisoning the well. Those who opposed the invasion of Iraq were quick to speculate regarding motives. Bush wanted to finish his father's work, or show his father he was stronger. Dick Cheney's Halliburton just wanted bigger contracts, or they were all out for the oil. If the invasion of Iraq was a bad idea, it was a bad idea independently of what motivated it. The same's true if it was a good idea. Talk of motivations didn't touch the real issue. In 2004, when campaigning for the presidency, John Kerry published a misery index intended to show that things have gotten worse under the Bush administration. The other side fired back, "John Kerry talks about the economy because he thinks it'll benefit him politically." True, perhaps, but irrelevant. That's just poisoning the well. Ad hominem. Okay, are you ready? It's time to play Name That Fallacy. I want you to listen to these three arguments. In each case, I want you to tell me what fallacy is being committed. Here's the first one.
As you know, most European countries have abolished the death penalty, with Turkey being the only country in recent years to carry out the death sentence. So it's clear the death penalty is immoral.
Here's argument number two.
All you hear in the current campaign is we need someone in Washington who's not a professional politician. But the people making that claim are lobbyists and politicians. So much for that claim.
Here's argument number three.
In 2011, Illinois abolished the death penalty. Did murders increase after abolition? No, they actually continued to decline. So why can't people understand that the death penalty doesn't prevent murders, it actually causes them?
Did you get those? The first one was an appeal to the majority. The premise was that most European countries have abolished the death penalty. Here the majority was countries, but the spirit's exactly the same. The conclusion was that the death penalty is immoral. But believing it so doesn't make it so, even when we're talking about the beliefs of a bunch of countries. That's the fallacy of appeal to the majority. The second one, ad hominem. The claim at issue was that we need a Washington outsider. A good argument would give us reasons to believe that's not true. But that's not what we get. What we get instead is an attack on the people making that claim, that they themselves are Washington insiders. The attack is on the people making the claim, not the claim itself. Ad hominem. Can you tell me the specific kind? That's right, tu quoque, you too. And the last one, post hoc ergo propter hoc. What the premise gives us is two data points. Illinois abolished the death penalty in 2011. Murders continued to fall after abolition. That's all we've got. The conclusion drawn is that there was a causal connection between those data points. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. Roll up your sleeve. I want to inoculate you against another fallacy, the fallacy of false alternative, also called false dilemma. The trick of a false alternative or false dilemma is to set things up as if the opponent has to choose either A or B. It's a false alternative because it may not be true at all. There may be lots more options open.
Look, either you marry Julie and have a wonderful life and family, or you spend the rest of your life as a lonely bachelor. Now go ahead, make up your mind. Julie's waiting.
That's clearly a false alternative. Are those your only options? Of course not. A lonely bachelor? Maybe you'll live your life as a gregarious, fun-loving bachelor instead. You might end up marrying Julie and not having a wonderful life. You could move to Alaska, start a commune, marry someone else, and live happily ever after. Sorry, Mom. Bogus argument. That's a false alternative. There's a famous case of false alternative used by George W. Bush in the State of the Union address. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. But as I said in the beginning, neither side has a lockdown on fallacies. Barack Obama used false alternatives in a State of the Union address as well, not once, but twice. Either we ask the wealthiest Americans to pay their fair share in taxes, or we're going to have to ask seniors to pay more for Medicare. We can't afford to do both. Either we gut education and medical research, or we've got to reform the tax code so that the most profitable corporations have to give up tax loopholes that other companies don't get. We can't afford to do both. Options in both cases are far more complex than that. It's not just an either-or. Trying to make it look that way is the fallacy of false alternative. Here's a fallacy that takes the nefarious strategy of the false alternative a little farther. It's called the complex question. The classic example is a lawyer who's prosecuting someone for wife beating. The accused is put on the stand and told to answer merely yes or no to the questions put to him. The prosecutor says, "Tell me, Mr. Smith, have you stopped beating your wife yet?" He's got to say yes or no. But if he says yes, the prosecutor says, "Aha, you say you have stopped beating your wife, so you admit you beat her in the past, I rest my case." If he says no, the prosecutor says, "What? You say you haven't stopped beating your wife? You admit you're still beating her? I rest my case." It's a trick question. It's a trap. The defendant is forced to say yes or no. Either answer is legitimate only on a certain assumption, that he has beaten his wife. He's forced into a false alternative, each side of which begs the question against him. Hasty generalization is a fallacy of jumping to a conclusion. You know something about a small number of things. You jump to a conclusion about all of them.
The first person I met on Long Island was short and rude. The second person I met on Long Island was short and rude. I guess everybody on Long Island must be short and rude.
Racist and sexist generalizations are one of the worst kinds of generalizations. And those are quite generally hasty generalizations.
Did you see what that Polish guy did? Polish people must be stupid.
Every Italian guy that's come in this week has bought shoe polish. Italians just want to buy shoe polish.
Every woman I've dated was a big tipper. Women are just big tippers.
Hasty generalizations wrong for all kinds of reasons. In other lectures, we've talked about the fallacy of appeal to emotion. The purpose of argument is to give solid reasons for believing a conclusion. An appeal to emotion is intended to short-circuit rationality, to manipulate a hearer by pressing emotional buttons instead. Appeal to ignorance is equally illegitimate. Here the fallacy is to act as if our ignorance is something more than it is, as if ignorance alone gives us some kind of positive evidence. Here's an example.
Many ships and planes have utterly disappeared in the regions of the Bermuda Triangle, often without explanation, without physical trace. There must be some kind of mysterious force at work beneath the waves.
Earlier, I emphasized a simple fact. Believing it so doesn't make it so. Here's another simple fact. Ignorance is just ignorance. If we don't know something, we just don't know it. Ignorance isn't by itself evidence for something. A mysterious force beneath the waves, for example. Evidence for a mysterious force would require real evidence, not just ignorance, not just lack of evidence. Here's another example.
How do we know that Oswald acted alone? How do we know this wasn't some massive conspiracy and that our own government hasn't simply covered it up? We haven't yet heard the real truth about the Kennedy assassination.
You'll notice that's driven entirely by nothing more than questions. The argument works entirely from ignorance and yet treats how do we know as if it offered a definite conclusion. We haven't yet heard the truth about the Kennedy assassination. Could there be grounds to think that? Certainly. But a bunch of questions aren't grounds. They're just questions. Okay, are you ready for another round? It's time to play Name That Fallacy. This time it'll be cumulative. Watch for all the fallacies we've mentioned. I'll give you three arguments. You tell me the fallacies.
First, they tell us that hormone replacement therapy is good for the health of women after menopause. Comes to find out, hormone replacement therapy actually leads to some serious health risks. First, they tell us that a certain medication is good for avoiding high blood pressure and heart disease. Then they'd say that that same medication is linked to diabetes, which is itself linked to heart disease. So I guess you really just can't trust medical research.
Here's a second argument.
No one knows exactly how the ancient pyramids were built. Why did the ancient South Americans, separated by thousands of miles, build pyramids just as the ancient Egyptians did? How did primitive peoples erect the massive pillars of Stonehenge? And how were the stones of Machu Picchu fitted so closely together that even a knife cannot slip between them? The answer is obviously the influence of ancient astronauts.
Argument number three.
It's time to use the three strikes law to get tough on crime. Anyone that gets convicted of three felonies should go to jail for life. Look, we gotta make a choice. You either slam the door and throw away the key, or we're just coddling these people, encouraging recidivism, and using our prison system to educate career criminals. In Washington state, the law passed with a majority. In California, it was 72% of the vote. It's time to use three strikes to get tough on crime.
Did you catch the fallacies? The first one was a hasty generalization. We have two cases in which health recommendations have been reversed. That's hardly grounds for the conclusion that we can't trust any medical research. Hasty generalization. No one knows exactly how the pyramids were built. Exactly. No one knows. From that ignorance, it doesn't follow that ancient astronauts were responsible, nor, of course, that they weren't. The third argument was a tricky one because it involved two fallacies. Look, we've got to make a choice. Either we coddle criminals or go for three strikes. That's a false alternative. California passed it with 72% voter approval. That's appealed to the majority. As I said at the beginning, there's no guarantee that you won't find two or more fallacies being committed at the same time. My aim in this lecture was to vaccinate you against some standard forms of bogus arguments, to inoculate you against some fallacies. I want to finish with a question as to how this fits in with some of our earlier work. That question might be posed as a set of challenges. Wait a minute. One of the other lecturers introduced wisdom of crowds as a positive heuristic. Isn't that just appeal to the majority? What about the example of which is larger, San Antonio or San Diego? The German students made a correct inference from the fact that they had heard of San Diego and not of San Antonio. Isn't that just appeal to ignorance? The conclusion of another lecturer was that in short-range decisions, it may be rational to go with your gut. Isn't that just an instance of hasty generalization? Take a closer look, and you'll see that there are important differences. Wisdom of crowds doesn't just recommend that you think what everybody else thinks. It's a strategy for extracting knowledge from a distribution of opinions where some people really do know the answer, like the studio audience of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. It doesn't just copy other people's beliefs, like appeal to the majority does. It draws a clever inference, though a fallible one, from the distribution of beliefs. In the San Diego-San Antonio case, the German students did better than Americans in picking the larger city precisely because they knew something about one and were largely ignorant of the other. Why have I heard of San Diego and I'm not so sure about San Antonio? Maybe because it's larger. That's a clever inference, though admittedly a risky one. It's not a simple jump from, I don't know how ancient monuments were built, to, it must have been ancient astronauts. There's also an important difference of context. When there's no time for careful investigation, when you have to get out of the way of an oncoming train, fast and frugal heuristics are precisely what you need. Better to go with your gut and jump to a conclusion, even if it might be wrong, than to wait on the tracks trying to calculate the velocity of an approaching locomotive. In the case of explicit argument, the standards for rationality are higher. There we want more than a handy heuristic. When someone is trying to convince us of a conclusion, and when we do have time to really think about it, it's important to test how tight the logic really is. Do the premises really support the conclusion? How strongly? Does the conclusion really follow? Or is this a bogus argument built with fallacious reasoning? We'll do more with that next time. It'll be your turn to evaluate arguments in the great debate. Welcome to the great debate. This isn't the Lincoln-Douglas debate, though that's not a bad precedent. As noted in an earlier lecture, Lincoln and Stephen Douglas were rival candidates for the Senate from Illinois. In August through October of 1858, they held 7 face-to-face debates in towns across the state. Papers across the country printed those debates in full. The purpose of all debates is to mold opinion. Lincoln knew that. In the very first debate, he says, "Public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. He who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes or pronounces decisions. He makes statutes and decisions possible or impossible." The debate you're about to hear won't rise to the level of Lincoln and Douglas, but I want you to use it to hone your skills in argument analysis, putting to work some of what we've covered. I'll interrupt at various points to ask you to analyze what you've heard. I'm particularly interested in your applying what we've talked about in evaluating parts of the